Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net. Happy New Year from the world's longest running football fans podcast. Yes, we are in our 10th anniversary year here at Celtic Underground, and I hope you had a fantastic festive period. And as I say, may your worst of 2016 be your best of 2015. Fantastically for me, my wife got me a turntable for Christmas, so I have been having a wonderful time pulling all the vinyl out of the loft and downloading it and sticking it on my iTunes, as well as finally sorting out my NAS drive in my house for those who are IT literate, and sorting out so that it stores all my iTunes. So I'm currently at 14,000 songs from my CDs and vinyl and have a lot to go. Needless to say, there's quite a lot of stuff that I've been pulling out and thinking, who bought that crap? Anyway, it'll all be coming on the podcast soon. So, hope you're looking forward to the mental banging tunes that we'll be doing in the 10th anniversary year of the podcast. Got some good guests coming up. But to start the year, I thought we'd have a review. And since there's been so many games since the last podcast, just before Christmas, it's St Anthony back on. We will be, or we are, reviewing the St Mirren and Thistle games. And no pyro, no party, allegedly. And also a wee bit touching on Anthony Stokes and the transfer window. So, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying, let's have a great 2016, chatting away to Mr. St Anthony. Joined by St Anthony. Saint, did you have a good Christmas and New Year?
Very quiet, but very pleasant, Harry.
Excellent. And it'd be one of the reasons we'd be very quiet is because we had virtually no football since our last podcast.
No, there's not a lot been happening. And even the Scottish Cup game against Stranraer was pretty low-key. So it'll be interesting to see if the weeks ahead there's more interest in it.
So, of the games that have been since our last podcast, the first one was the Thistle game at home with the dramatic last gasp winner. That was the Derby game on January 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you enjoy that game?
I never enjoyed the game as such, but I was pretty proud in the end up because I think the old Celtic fighting spirit came at the fore in the end. And what it also showed was there was, when we were down to 10 men, it was maybe about 10 minutes to go, there was a great chant around the stadium of Celtic, Celtic. Just a straightforward, loud chant that gets louder and louder and louder. And it started off, and before you knew it, it cascaded around the whole stadium. And I honestly believe that that chant gave the team heart and pressed them on, because they weren't playing very well up to that point. And in the last 10 minutes, we could have scored two or three goals, even though Thistle were at full strength, and we were down to 10 men. And it goes to show how there is a bond there between the fans and the players. And I wish the fans would appreciate a wee bit more that, you know, that the players go, hopefully maybe 7 or 8 times out of 10, the players will go on the pitch at Celtic Park and entertain us. And they might not need a great deal of backing, but there's always going to be a game, 1 in 5 or maybe even 1 in 10, for whatever reason it is, things go against us and the team's not playing well, and that's when the Celtic support traditionally were always at their best, because they would shout and roar the team on and encourage them, and I honestly think that happened that day against Thistle, and I was so pleased when we get the winning goal, because I think the team deserved it. There was only one team going to score at that point, because I think Thistle had maybe sat in the hope of getting a point. and also the supporters got behind the team the way that it should be, and I hope that that's something we can take to heart.
Do you know, it was one of those ones where I remember actually on the way home saying that game was rubbish, but the amazing thing is in the 4 minutes that Sports Scene gives us for highlights, I could make that game look really good.
I know. Because
your point of actually once we went down to 10 men, I know you're saying about Thistle sitting in, I felt once we went to 10 men, Thistle suddenly thought they had a chance of winning the game. And although they didn't, I think they had one decent effort. But they...
McGregor kicked one off the line.
That's right.
Either him or Tierney kicked one off the line. So.
But the game seemed to suddenly get stretched when we went to 10 men because they moved to two up front, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there was space. And there was 3 or 4 occasions where we looked like we might score before we did actually score.
Yep,
it was really odd. It was a rubbish game, yet we looked like we could score.
The irony is that we made more chances with 10 men than we did with 11.
Yeah.
Which I couldn't have seen happening when Beaton got sent off. And also have to say that he worked his ticket because he'd been booked. He made a foul, but he could have been sent off just before it had the referee not been lenient. And he must have known he was in thin ice. And he went in with a stupid challenge. And then he tried to feign surprise when he gets sent off. Now, I don't know what went through his mind that day because I like Beaton. I think he's a class act. But he disappointed me that day.
You're right, and I was surprised when I saw people having a go that it was two soft yellow cards that he got. And yes, the second one was soft, but equally, as you pointed out, he did a challenge just before it that could have been a yellow card. And see, when I watched it on the telly, it appeared to be not much difference between him going in for the challenge and getting the yellow card. But see, watching it in the game, and I'm in the north stand, so I was watching it from, you could beat on, I'm watching the pitch, beat on, and then the bench. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really struck me was, beat on went in for that challenge. The first one where he could have got a second booking. And I remember seeing Ronnie Dyla really pointing at him and gesticulating at him as if, watch out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he went to the second one where he did get the second yellow card, he sort of stood about as if he was waiting to get booked. And as I say, although it was all very quick, my recollection is I can remember both Collins and Dyla being out the dugout and telling him to run, to move and get away. As if get back into the pack very quickly and the referee will forget about it. But I felt he was, as you say, working his ticket. Not quite literally, but I felt it was as if he was standing waiting for the referee to give him that second booking.
I think some of the continental players that we have, and we've had them in the past as well, it's not a new thing, but sometimes they're just no in the mood and it can be quite temperamental, and I think that was one such occasion.
Well, you say continental players, the player that I remember doing that most would be Chris Sutton. I can remember saying to my brother, the game at Ibrox where he gets sent off, actually, I can remember 10 minutes into that game saying, you'd be just as well substituting Sutton now because he's not in the mood and he wants to, he'll either be useless or get sent off today. Because he used to be one of these people who, I don't know whether it was he just felt it just wasn't clicking for him that day and he would just be a waste of space.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing that the Sports Scene highlights were dreadful for, that at the game, I remember thinking, was Chiefchi's goal offside? Because I'm at the other side, not at the right angle. And see, when I watched it back on Sports Scene, and I paused it, it was neck and neck as to whether Chiefchi's goal was offside or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the two penalty claims. The one where the guy dived in with 2 feet on Rodic, I think it was, and then there was the other one with the shot with the guy, it hit the guy's hands.
The one with the handball, I think, would have been a wee bit harsh because it came so quickly at him. You know, it almost I think it hit him rather than the man playing the ball. But the tackle, I think he was lucky because the Celtic player was going out of the area. You know, he was going away for goal, but when he came in for the back, and I think if the Celtic player had been going towards goal, then that would have been a Stonewall penalty.
So, overall, it wasn't the greatest. I suppose the other way of looking at it is, Thistle had just played our nearest challengers in the title race, also at their ground and drawn.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a win. So we got 3 points and moved on. And then there was the St Ronard game. Did you get to see the whole game on the telly?
Oh, yeah, yep.
So what did you think?
I think it was a professional performance. I was at St Ronard the last time we played them in 2001, so I know it's a really a tight wee place to go. It actually was a good atmosphere because it was old-fashioned cup tie football. And in fairness to the St Ronard players, you know, they get stuck in, but they weren't, never at any time did I think they were being dirty. They were... they stayed within the laws of the game, and I think the first goal is always going to be an important one in occasions like that. And Griffiths is just terrific. You know, I can't see by him. I think he's a wonderful player. I think he's matured in the last 12 months. And I think if there's a shrink to Ronnie's bow, it's the fact that his development of Griffiths has been exceptional. And the Shrinar, I don't think Shrinar really had a... I think Ambrose had a... He was maybe a wee bit lucky with a penalty claim, although his arm was at his side. And the rest of the game was a formality. You know, it's just a case of how many we were going to score. But the interesting thing for me was Scott Allen put a great pass through for Griffiths to get the third goal.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I know it's only Shrinar, and I know that Shrinar were tired and when Allen came on as a sub, but every time I see Scott Allen, I'm impressed. He's always looking to go forward. He always passes the ball forward. He's always moving into space. I think he's such a clever player. And it frustrates me that Ronnie's not giving him a chance at the beginning, especially in games at Celtic Park. And I think there's a couple of guys in the team who are maybe living in a reputation. And I think Scott Allen's long overdue getting 90 minutes to establish himself in the midfield.
So who would you put him in ahead of?
I don't think it's a secret that Johansson's not having a great season. And he did play badly on Sunday. And in the last couple of games, he's probably played better than he has been recently. But I still feel that I would like to see Allen get the chance. And another thing as well is, I know Callum McGregor's a bit of a whipping boy because he's maybe... a young boy and he's maybe not everybody's cup of tea, but I think the problem with Callum is I don't think he's a central midfield player. I think he's at his best when he goes to one of the wide goals, whether it's on the left or on the right, cutting on his left foot. And I think that's where he's had his best games. So I think if you're going to play anybody in the middle with it, then I don't think I would be putting Callum McGregor there. I think I would be putting in either Scott Allen or Rogic or something like that to play in that role.
So if you do you think Scott Allen's best position is effectively the number 10 position?
I think Scott Allen could do a job there, but I also think that he's more than capable of playing as one of the two holding players. Because I think that one thing that he's got is he is probably, in my opinion, the best passer in the team. And when I say that, I mean a guy who can pick a pass, just look up and maybe make a... find a player in between two opponents, you know, like thread balls through. He's like a continental type player. Whereas I think the rest of them are almost programmed to pass it to the side, pass it to the side, pass it back, pass it to the side, which is good in terms of keeping possession. But at some point, you have to play the killer pass. And I think that Scott Allen, in the short time that he's been there, seems to me the kind of guy who has that in his locker, who can unlock a defence and play a ball into space for a striker or for an attacking midfield player to run on it. And I just hope that we get to see a wee bit more of him in the weeks ahead.
Do you really think, my thoughts are that part of his issue is his best position is number 10.
Mm.
And so he's competing with Rogic and Commons for that spot. And that's possibly the biggest reason why he's not been getting in the team.
Well, Collins has had a shocker this season. I don't think he's contributed anything this season off the top of my head that I can think of. Rogic is a different kettle of fish. He's made a big impression. My problem with Rogic is you get a good 55, 60 minutes out of Rogic and then he disappears, which leads me to think that he might not be as fit as we would like him to be. he seems to fade out of games. And the other thing about Rogic as well is that when you play against a better class opposition, I think he looks a bit slow and a bit cumbersome.
Yeah, I think his when we played in Europe, although to be fair, I think Rogic's best, one of his better games was in Europe at home to Ajax when we started the game with a 4-1-4-1.
Yeah.
And then we changed it to 4-4-1-1, and he played the holding role in the 4-1-4-1, and then mm-hmm. played the number 10 role in the 4-4-1-1 thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've sometimes been I've referred to him as the Australian Paddy McCourt, and that he's got great feet, but your point in general holds, I think. He's just not got the additional level of pace that is needed at the top level when you play in Europe, with the exception of
that. And he's not the only one in that bracket. I mean, we've got a few players like that who had a ton of pace. They'd have been world beaters. Paddy McCourt comes into that. Paddy just didn't have a ton of pace.
No.
Either. We've had a few players like that who are very skillful players but don't have that burst. And then you've got guys like Forrest who do have the burst, but lack a wee bit of composure and lack a wee bit of technique.
And then I think you're right about the commons. I can't think of commons doing anything particular. I mean, even the games where people might turn around and say, oh, but in this game or that game, mm-hmm. it will be a goal he scored. And whilst, yes, I accept, obviously, goals win football matches, but an attacking midfield player needs to do more than score a long-range shot every so many games.
The thing about commons is that if you play him in a number 10, he's not going to be a runner. He's just going to be the guy who wants the body feet. But he plays in that role. Whereas I think at least the likes of Rogic and Scott Allan have got a wee bit of movement and move about the park and make space for other people. But I think the thing with commons is, I wonder if he throws a wee huff because he doesn't really like playing in the wide areas cutting in. And the last few games he's played, he hasn't been the number 10. He's been the guy on either side. And then he just drifts out the game. In fact, I was a wee bit annoyed with I think it may have been the official game, that Rogic got taken off and Coleman stayed in the park. Because Rogic, even though he may have been tiring, was A, putting in a wee bit more effort, and B, contributing a lot more than Chris Commons was. I mean, Commons, frankly, was a passenger that day.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things I'd said after that game was I couldn't understand why Rogic, I think when Rogic got off, people booed.
I think they're booing because they thought Commons or somebody else, maybe McGregor or somebody, should have been the guy coming off.
Well, you see,
and it was unfair that it always seems to be Rogic.
Yeah, but you see, I was looking at it thinking you could pair him any one of those three. You could have taken off any one. I was looking at that game thinking any one of Rogic, Commons and McGregor could have gone off.
They were, if you're going to be frank about it, then apart from the boy Tierney, then you could have turned anyone for 10.
Oh, you, exactly.
It was a horrible game, and as much as it's strange to see so many players have a bad game collectively.
And so, yeah, I agree. My point was, I couldn't understand the booing of Rogic because it wasn't as if he was dramatically miles better than anybody else. They were all crap that day.
Mm-hmm.
But since it gets back to based on the way the manager thinks, what's the likely substitution? The likely substitution to try and change something in this game is to change one of Rogic, Commons and McGregor. And my thoughts about why I would have agreed on taking off Rogic is the point you've made about Commons is a waste of space. Earlier in the game, I'd said the same thing you've said. See, when Commons is out wide, it's sometimes as if you get a man down, because it looks like he can't be bothered playing out wide and just sort of neither plays in the number 10 role because there's already somebody there, Rogic, nor does he play out wide because he doesn't want to. So the consequence is you've not actually got, you know, I think he was, I can't remember where it was, but I think it was for a period he was playing on the right. And so Lustig had no support for going down. And my point about why I didn't see why people were booing the Rogic thing, because if you'd taken Commons off, Rogic was being useless in the number 10 position.
Mm-hmm.
If you take Rogic off,
and you move Commons across to the number 10 position, you have the possibility that Commons comes out of his huff and does a bit better. And then you can put Forrest out wide or whoever it was that came on.
My problem with Ronnie's formations from the beginning is, and I still believe this to be the case, he doesn't have the players to play the formation that he plays. Now, he likes 4-2-3-1, he swears by it, and he's entitled to play it because he's the manager. And so far, anyway, he's been relatively successful with the way that the shape of the team that he plays. But when you've got 4-2-3-1, the two guys on either side of the three really have to be natural wide players, because that's where you're looking to get your width.
Yep.
No, I know that the fullbacks attack, but essentially fullbacks are there as defenders. And I've never felt that he has found two players to fill those roles. It's almost as if he's trying to put square pegs in round holes.
Fullbacks supposed to be defenders. Actually, in the way that Ronnie plays it, he virtually plays with two at the back and the two centre-halves, which is why it worked with De Nier and Van Dijk, because they had pace. And why we've looked risky at times with our current two, because they don't have the same pace.
Yeah,
and actually,
yeah,
it's the two fullbacks who are expected to get boxed, who are to get byline to byline. And in some ways, you then play with inverted wingers who cut inside.
Well, part of the problem that we've got with that at the moment is that the boy Tierney will run on Defia, and he's a decent crosser. So he's ideal in as much as that's what Ronnie's looking for from a fullback. Lustig's legs have gone. And when he gets the ball, 30 yards, 25 yards, 30 yards for goal, he just looks to cross it from where he's standing. He makes no effort to get by a guy. He's got a big rangy run when he gets going. But I just feel that his days of being a fullback are coming to an end, because he doesn't have the energy to play there. And if you're going to play Lustig in future, then it might be as a centre-back rather than a fullback. Because in that lineup that Ronnie plays that you've just described very well, the onus isn't the fullbacks to get forward, but you must see it yourself. Lustig can't run. He makes no attempt to run down the wing, to get into space, to get by a man. He gets the ball, he looks up, and he either passes it or launches a long ball.
Well, I do know in the summer,
from a deep position,
Adam Matthews was for a start, we wanted him to take I don't know if we wanted him to take a pay cut or we weren't going to give him a pay rise. Because if you remember, Adam Matthews came... Did he come on a free?
He came on a free for Cardiff.
Yeah, but it was because of his contractual position, and actually... So we were paying him more than we wanted to pay him. And I can't remember if he was offered a pay cut or the same salary, but he was told his opportunities in the first team would go up because Lustig was going to be playing more games as a centre-half this season.
Yeah.
But he and his agent wanted the pay rise, and he went. So we then signed Sadie Yankel, who's been out injured now for 15 weeks, I think.
See, this is a sign. Again, you're never quite sure at Celtic, because there's rumours.
He's on crutches.
Is he on crutches?
Aye.
Right, well, I don't think that's been made clear, because you hear rumours about he doesn't like it here, he wants a transfer, you know, and maybe the truth is it's simply that The boy, how did he get the injury?
I've no idea, but the only reason I asked somebody at Celtic, is Yanko injured? Same thing as you. One of my big bugbears is they don't tell you when players are injured.
No.
So what happens is sometimes with players like Yanko, they come, they pick up an injury. People, because they've picked up an injury quite quickly after they've come, people forget that it's an injury. And you hear people going saying things like, that Yanko must be really shit because he hardly gets a game.
Well,
there's nowhere to go. There should be a thing on the website that says injured.
Injury updates or whatever, you know.
Now, I understand why. I understand sometimes there may be a reason why a player's been dropped, but they don't want to say he's been dropped. So if you have this always updated injury status thing, you would then know more readily when people have been dropped. So I understand that thought process as to why they don't. But equally, they could have, once somebody's a long-term injury, they could easily put it. So the only reason I asked and somebody said to me, he's been out injured for 13 weeks. So this was, maybe that was about 3 weeks ago, so maybe about 16 weeks. He's been out injured for 13 weeks. And then the next day, I saw somebody tweet a picture of him going into Celtic Park, and he was walking in on crutches. So I've no idea what it is. I just know he was in crutches just before Christmas and he's been out for 16 weeks.
Well, we do have a village mentality at Celtic, you know. It's, although we've got a big support, the rumours spread like wildfire.
Yeah.
And you hear things and, you know, that are maybe true or untrue or whatever. But the whole thing about that boy is, even when he played, I don't think he was doing particularly well.
I thought he was doing all right. He only played three or four. I think he's only played about four games or something. I thought there was a game he played at Celtic Park, and he was doing the job of what a full back at Celtic Park needs to do most of his games, which is attack with the ball. I thought he did all right. But the other aspect from the Stranraer game, if we get back to that, was the flares. You're a boring old fart like me, right? What's your thoughts on the flares?
Well, my thoughts on the flares are A, they're not allowed, B, they are dangerous, and C, there's a wee element amongst the Celtic support that just are so bloody minded that they just want to do their own thing regardless of the damage that they'll do to the club in terms of the reputation of the supporters and the punishment that might come Celtic's way from the authorities. So it's threefold.
So I'm trying to think of the defence for doing it, right, that I've seen people say, so I'll try and put these to you. It adds to the atmosphere.
I don't see how it adds to the atmosphere.
No. Right.
I think if you're singing songs, it adds to the atmosphere. There you go.
Right, okay. I like it, so I'll do it.
Again, you might like a drink as well, but if you bring a bottle of beer in, you're going to get the jail because it's against the law. And as far as I'm aware, pyro, or whatever you want to call it, flares, are against the law also, that it's not allowed. You know, I don't think they can quite get that in their minds, that it's that there is a basically a law against it at football matches.
I like it, so I'll do it because I'm a selfish bastard.
That's what it basically comes down to.
It is. I actually put it down to, it's the legacy of Thatcher's children. These are all Thatcher's children.
Mm-hmm.
Where the most important thing is your own self-fulfilment and self-enjoyment, and the concept of living in a pluralistic society where you take into account the consideration of others is an up-your-jacksies concept.
Mm-hmm.
I put it down to as simply as that. These people are just selfish and couldn't care less. Because I've heard people say things like, Why are we bothered about what other people think of us?
Yeah, there's always been a wee bit an element of that in the Celtic support, even in my years. I mean, I can think back to when I was a boy and teenagers used to drink bottles of wine, Eldorado in the main, and they would start singing obscene songs, not Irish rebel songs particularly, but they would sing things like about Derek Johnson's wife or that kind of thing, you know, totally offensive and inappropriate for a football game, especially when I was kids there. So you've always had that wee sort of teenage element between the ages of maybe 16 and 20 who are determined to do their own thing and create their own identity. I think the problem may come if Celtic are bloody minded enough, they will say, lay an ultimatum down to them and say, the next time that you turn up with pyro or flares and embarrass the club, the immediate away game after that, we will take away tickets, but we will not distribute them, and we will play without any support, but we will also give the opposition the money for the tickets. So really what you're doing is you're costing the club money. So say we get 3,000 tickets at £25 a go, that's £75,000. And turn them into the next away game and say, so that the home team don't lose it in any finance, and just leave the stand empty and say, this is what we'll do every time until you get the message that this is entirely unacceptable. And it seems quite a harsh thing to do, because you are punishing the good supporters, the 99% of the guys who follow the team faithfully away from home, and put in a lot of money and a lot of time and put their heart and soul on it. And I'm, you know, that would be a very difficult thing to do. But I think the club are at the stage now that what can you do? Something's got to be done.
I mean, there's a couple of things that people have talked around the subject. So this isn't condoning the flares in any way, because anybody knows what my attitude to it is similar to what you've just said. The one thing, some of the things I do agree with in what people have said is, in the same weekend, only because I work with a Dunfermline fan, I know that two flares from the Ross County fans made their way into, when they were thrown, landed in the main stand at Dunfermline, which is wooden.
Oof.
Right? Where have you seen the vast array of criticism of Ross County?
Well, I haven't heard any condemnation about that. In fact, that's news to me, because I haven't heard anything at all.
I can even tell you one was a blue flare and one was a red flare.
Well, I'm sure our supportive aren't the only ones who are using the pyro stuff. But to be honest, I'm not concerned with Ross County fans or anybody else.
I'm just saying in terms of people's... One of the things is saying, why do people keep picking on Celtic for doing it when there's Ross County? Well, my argument to that is because we're bigger and more important.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simplest reason. And then the other... I suppose the other point that you could... If you were external to Celtic, you could criticise Celtic. You remember after the Motherwell, the thing at Firth Park...
Two seasons ago,
When it resulted in the brief banning of the Green Brigade. That was at the time when lots of clubs were selling, and then there was the Dundee thing as well. That was at the time when clubs were selling directly.
To the supporters rather than to the club.
Correct. And Celtic said, we'll take it back in-house so that we can determine who gets the tickets. So, as I get a text from a Rangers fan, and I would say, you know, he's a reasonable Rangers fan, I would say he's not one of his question to me was, if Celtic keep saying there's not much they can do, why did he keep selling tickets to these guys?
Yeah, that's a hard thing as well, because
we took them off clubs saying, well, the reason why it happened at Dundee and it happened at Motherwell was because we weren't in control of who got tickets.
Yeah,
so we couldn't stop the people that we knew that might be naughty boys doing this.
Yeah, but I think that the thing is, even if you take control of the tickets and you distribute them and you keep a note of people, how can you tell an exact seat who is waving pyro? And the other thing is as well, is it's kind of noticeable that there's no pyro at Celtic Park. To my recollection, this season I don't remember any pyro at Celtic Park. And it's almost as if these guys, the younger element amongst the supporters, show off a wee bit when they go away from home, because they know they will not get caught. Whereas if they did it at Celtic Park, I think they could be easily identified, and more to the point, the supporters round about them would point them out.
See, your other comment there about, you know, you always get young, you know, there's always a group of young kids doing something which is frowned upon by people at the time that it's happening. And I get that point. And actually, the thing that really struck me within the context of that is the Offensive Behaviour Act and the way that people are policed. Now, through family circumstances, you know, there was a period there where I would be going to, I think there would maybe only be two or three away league games in a season that I would miss, and I'd be going to many of the away European games and stuff. And through family circumstances, I don't really get to many away games now. So... I'm not really, since the Offensive Behaviour Act came in, I'm not really experiencing what people are experiencing at away games. Or you read people experiencing. However, see, when we went to Murrayfield, an example of the counterproductiveness of policing, and your point about young guys showing off when they can be the centre of attention. I remember going to Murrayfield, walking along, and there's a wee group of guys walk along, and a couple of them were singing songs, and they were a bit nondescript, and nobody really noticed them. And suddenly, out of nowhere, the police arrived and sort of kettled them in a bit, and then they got almost like a bubble escort to the game.
Mm-hmm.
See, the second that happened, it was as if they'd all grown a foot in height. And they were singing, and all the Celtic supporters were suddenly looking at them. And I say the way they were policed made them this potential threat that they hadn't been prior to the police turning up. Because suddenly they became more aggressive. And I'm not saying that they were a threat, but you get the point I make about suddenly they became more forthright and more and louder in their singing. And I actually thought to myself, what you're doing is counterproductive, police. You're giving these guys, you're making these guys, giving them a feeling of self-importance that there's some danger associated with them, that they need policed in this way. They were just wee 15 to 80-year-old Neds, spotty Neds, walking along the street prior to you turning up.
I think that there's a certain contradiction in the guys who use the pyro. And on one hand, they brazenly flout the rules and wave these flares. And then on the other hand, they complain about the Offensive Behaviour Act. And they think that they're getting victimised somehow. But there is a connection here as well. If you're going to wave flares at games and pyro or whatever you want to call it, then you're giving the authorities an excuse to clamp down on you. You're giving the authorities an excuse to talk you down in the press and say to the public in general, look, this is why we're doing this here. Because these people can't be trusted to behave properly at a football game. Therefore, we have to bring in laws in order to keep them in check. Now, the thing is, I think most of us, I think any reasonable-minded person knows that this Offensive Behaviour Act is a lot of garbage. The police don't like it. The judiciary don't like it. Most of the politicians don't like it, but the SNP are so bloody minded that they're keeping it going. And it was quite interesting to see Jeanette Finlay take on McCaskill the other day in Hollywood, because apparently I've seen a wee bit of it on Twitter, but I'm going to watch the whole thing at some point. But apparently he had a terrible attitude towards Jeanette and the other guy there, Paul, I can't remember his second name now. Can come back to me. So the two of them are there to campaign against this act, and apparently McCaskill's attitude was horrendous. And I think that's what you're up against in this country, that there's definitely a middle class attitude of towards the working class football fan. Of, you know, we don't like you. You're an embarrassment to the nation. And I'm not talking about Celtic fans in general, I'm talking about football fans across the board.
But then, as you say, you then go and behave with the pyro. And it gives them an excuse to say, see, we need all these things that we do.
But that's my point.
We're protecting you from these evil hordes who are going to run amok.
The guys who do the pyro are contradicting themselves, because on the one hand they wave the pyro and then the next hand they complain about the police having it in for them.
Although so the other point
on the evidence if you're going to behave like that.
The other point I would then make it, and this is my other continual point, I actually have sympathy for football clubs at times. Even, you know, well, let's use the Rangers example. Say I was a reasonable Rangers director, I know it's hard to believe. Say I was a director of Rangers and I was pretty reasonable and I found the Billy Boys offensive.
Mm-hmm.
How do I stop it?
Tell me.
No, it's a real question.
All right, I thought you were going to give me an answer.
No, I don't know. If I'm say I was a reasonable guy, how do I stop it?
Well, you would appeal to their better nature to begin with, and then you would put out warnings, and then you would. I really don't know. Although it's interesting to say that if you read Phil McGillivan's blog, that he claims that within the new board at Ibrox, there's one, if not two of them, that think that the Billy Boys is an acceptable song for a football game.
Well, I know they do, but my general point is, if you know, it's very difficult sometimes for football clubs to be held responsible for, you know, so say for instance it got to the point where one fanny letting off a flare at a Celtic away game was the final straw and Celtic had to close one stand for a home game in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your fault, my fault, is it Peter Lawwell's fault?
That's a guy with a flare.
Correct. I sometimes have a bit of sympathy, and in relation to that I sometimes think football is made to pay for policing. So it gets back to, was it today you tweeted a you tweeted the back page of the Daily of the Sunday Mail after
the
Scottish
riot.
Cup riot?
Yeah.
And I was looking at that and I was thinking, and nobody ever says, how did the police allow it to get to the point where they were on the pitch rioting?
No. Do you know who did say that, funny enough, if you ever hear him? Archie McPherson, I've heard commenting that in the past, and he said that, okay, fans on both sides should have been in a part of the horrendous scenes. He said, but the football fans across the country were made to pay after that, and the police basically got scot-free. In fact, the guy who was the chief of police at that time was a guy called Patrick McNee. I'm sure it was Patrick McNee. I can't remember if it was David McNee or Patrick McNee. But he actually got a knighthood on the back of the Riot Cup final, you know. So,
but my point is, football has to pay for policing and pays a lot of money. And whenever there's an event happens where there was more than one or two people took those flares into the Stranraer game.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't a defence of the people who are doing it. They shouldn't be doing it. But equally, what's football playing for if, when something kicks off, it's the clubs that get found guilty and have to pay fines? You know, if I ran a football club and trouble kicked off and I got fined for it, I would then have a sit-down meeting with the police who police the football and say, I'm deducting that from your costs.
Yeah.
You know, if I had, because if people, you know, like, when there's an external private security firm hired to do something and something goes wrong,
you can sue them.
People turn around and say, they shouldn't be getting paid, they shouldn't be getting that fee. You know, when Group 4 are transporting a prisoner and he escapes, there'll always be people saying they should lose that contract and they should be this. How many times have things happened at a football game and nobody has ever said, well, look, it's taken nearly 30 years for any justice to happen at Hillsborough. The only time in our lifetime I can think of where the police have been held responsible for what went wrong.
And then that took long enough to come to life.
Yeah, it's nearly 30 years and it was a conspiracy to prevent it. But the bulk of times, you know, when you see, as I say, through not going to away games, but there's somebody, I think it may have been Jeanette Finlay, tweeted a photograph of the police inspecting a bus on the way to Stranraer. You know, every Celtic away game, you will read Twitter of people saying buses are being pulled over at XYZ spot.
It's basically harassment, because the argument is that I know why the police are stopping the buses, because they want to see if there's any alcohol on it. But then again, if you were to stop a black guy in the street and search him for a knife, then people would begin to go like that. There's definitely, you're picking on a certain element of society, therefore that's not correct. I mean, we've had it done in London, where the police were described as being institutionally racist because black people were getting picked on. Now, if you're getting to the stage that, you know, every game that you go to, your bus is getting pulled up and getting searched for blank, that's just total utter harassment. There isn't any other word for it, because no other element of society is getting treated like that. You don't see cars getting put up to see if they've got every week to see if they've got dodgy tyres or whether they've got MOTs or insurance or whatever.
If they're doing all of that and they're going to that extreme, how come they're not finding any flares?
Well,
they're patently looking for the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time.
No, the thing is, I read that as well, and it said that it could be actually that the Stranraer, whatever police force it was, it could be that the police on Sunday were actually looking for flares other than drink, right? And, you know, obviously if they come across drink, then they've got to take action, right? And really what's happened is the guys who bring the pyro in could travel by car. Somebody thought that, well, we'll search every supporters bus and we'll find all this pyro stuff. And yet, you know, there's a guy driving by them in a car, basically thumbing their nose up, laughing, because they see the buses getting pulled and they're away scot-free in a car. It's ridiculous.
I mean, for me, you could actually get rid of it quite easily. See all the wasted money and resources. I mean, one thing that always goes through my mind, if we are playing away from home in Dingwall, and you get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there's all these tweets about the buses being pulled over at like 8 o'clock in XYZ place. Two things that go through my mind. One, really, police, have you got nothing better to do than on a Sunday morning pull over? And two, see police, if you do catch people taking a bevy at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning, see instead of doing them to do with breaking the law, I think you should take them to the hospital, because see, if you're drinking at 8 o'clock on a Sunday, if you need a bevy at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning, you've got a problem. Those are the two thoughts that go through my mind every time I see a tweet. Anybody that's bevying at 8 o'clock in the morning has got a personal problem, and the police are saddos for pulling people over. But instead of spending their time and resources in doing that, simple thing is, away games, if we are being particularly bad for it, you just say, dear Celtic fans, we are going to have a thorough cordon, which will be 100 yards or 200 yards from the turnstiles, and everybody's getting personally searched.
The other thing I would say is that the police are often going in the action, they're often doing things on the premise that politicians tell them to do certain things. And as I said to you there, there is, in the current climate, the government have got a downer on football fans in general. I'm not just talking about Celtic fans here, I think across the board. But I think the most disappointing thing for me is the SNP have got 54 MPs. Now, I know at least four of them are big Celtic fans, as in go to games, and they're seeing their own fans getting victimised by this offensive behaviour thing, and yet they will not put their head above the parapet because they've got blind loyalty to the party. Now,
but to be fair, Sain, can you tell me in our lifetime when Scottish football fans haven't been treated like that?
No, was that Harry? Sorry.
In our parking the SNP bit, tell me a point in our lifetime when Scottish football fans haven't been treated like second-class citizens.
No, but the point I'm about to make is that I think through the years that there has been MPs, in the main Labour MPs, who have come out and voiced their concern about certain things. It might not be to do with football fans, but even if it goes against party policy, they'll put their head above it and speak out. And there's something about the SNP, it's pretty insidious, because none of their MPs will ever speak out against them in any shape or form. It's almost like brainwashing. Now, the Labour movement through the years, for example, always had guys like, Corbyn's a classic example. Although he's the leader now, he was the biggest agitator for the backbenches. He always spoke out. He spoke out against the war in Afghanistan, in Iraq. You guys like George Galloway, you guys like...
but he gets chucked out of the party. Skinner.
What's that?
Galloway gets chucked out of the party.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, Wiley was a Labour MP, he spoke out against party policy. He spoke out against the leadership.
Aye,
when
so
it was something that he passionately believed in. Now, I don't believe that these Celtic supporting SNP MPs can in their hearts, can agree with what's happening with the offensive behaviour thing. And yet they will not put their head above the parapet. And I just think that's disappointing. Because at the end of the day, you're there to be an MP and represent the public. You're not there to, you may represent your party of sorts to get elected, but at the end of the day, you're the Member of Parliament for your constituents, not for your political party.
But who... What party hasn't... It's all well and good having the odd person who speaks out. What party has done something positive and proactive for football in the last 40 years?
I know. We should also point out here is that 30 years ago or so, we didn't exactly help ourselves with the Ryder Cup final and certain other instances that were happening.
Yeah, but then that gets back to the principle that I always felt. This is the difference between England and Scotland, and I'm not saying I ever want a disaster, but what happened was there was the continued downward spiral towards we need to control these thugs mentality of attitude to football fans. Then Heysel happened, then Hillsborough happened. and they pulled the, and they took the fences down. Because you remember, obviously, in England they had worse fences than us because they had the fences with the spikes pointing in. And then you had that Ken Bates talking about electrifying fences and putting moats around grounds and all that stuff. Then they took the fences away and they realised that actually when you treat people like civilised human beings, miraculously, people like you and me, who the rest of the week are law-abiding normal citizens, strangely enough, are also law-abiding citizens when we go to the football.
I know that the, you know yourself, that there was a certain, there was almost a professional hooligan back in the mid to late 1980s, especially then in England, but you had guys who were reasonably educated and held down fairly important jobs, and then on a Saturday they would turn into rave howling banshees and try and kill each other.
Yeah, but that was part of the them and us culture that the that the policing strategy took, that the Offensive Behaviour Act that we just talked about creates. I mean, I do think the pyro isn't, I think the pyro actually, if you want to get really philosophical, if you look at the whole of Europe, it's part of the general culture of people feeling disenfranchised from the establishment, and it's part of people just doing anti-establishment stuff. In Scotland itself, I think it's partly connected to the Offensive Behaviour Act of the them and us culture between the police and the supporters, and particularly those young supporters. I think it's as much part of that, and everybody needs to try and de-escalate where we are with it. I mean, Celtic, actually, you mentioned about Celtic Park. Credit needs to go to Celtic. Celtic de-escalated matters with the Green Brigade within Celtic Park. You know, things were getting, you know, there was banners that resulted at Celtic Park, which resulted us getting fines, and that's gone. You know, they were singing songs that caused problems. That's gone at Celtic Park. So the dialogue that's happened between the Green Brigade and Celtic at Celtic Park has obviously managed to, obviously Celtic banned them for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember being at a fans thing, and to be fair to Peter, it was a fans forum thing, to be fair to Peter Lawwell, it was at the time of the banning him, somebody said, I don't think you should have banned him. Well, what should we have done? Well, they need to have ground rules. Yeah, so what do you do when they break the rules? Well, there's obviously got to be consequences and people break the rules. Right, so what consequences do you have? Well, I just don't think it's very good to ban people. Right, so what would your consequences be? Well, I'm not happy with banning people. Yeah, but what would your consequences be? Well, eventually you've got to do something with people who break the rules. Yeah, but if you have dialogue with them and they keep breaking the rules. You know, and I did think, I understand the point, the guy doesn't want the concept of banning people, but equally the guy was agreeing that this comes to a point where you need to do something. And patently, it got to the point where they were banned, and whatever the dialogue was between Celtic and the Green Brigade at Celtic Park, there was a de-escalation.
Yeah.
And your point about the SNP thing and bloody-minded, I think you're right. There has become, I actually think part of what's made this, I think some of the songs that people don't like that fall under the Offensive Behaviour Act had virtually disappeared from Celtic fans' repertoire. You never heard them at Celtic Park, and they were becoming less and less away from home. And when the Offensive Behaviour Act came in, they came back at Celtic Park amongst some parts of the support, and they came back away from home. Because I think your point of there's always an element of young people wanting to stick their nose up at authority.
See, times have changed because years ago, when I was a boy and I went to the games, not every game was televised, right? So you would get highlights of maybe one in three Celtic games. There wasn't any live games, maybe apart from the cup final. So we would sing songs. Now, I don't mean this to sound bad, but if there was Irish rebel songs being sung, it was accepted practice that was our identity or our culture. And that's what we sang. And there was times that I don't mind some of the milder ones, but I can remember going to see Celtic during really powder keg times such as the hunger strikers or the Shankill Butchers, things that were really happening in Northern Ireland, which came across the channel and affected us very slightly because you were getting the news, you were keeping abreast of what was happening, and you knew that there was terrible things happening, that the army were doing terrible things, The paramilitaries were doing terrible things. The whole situation was really tragic. Now, our supporters would find certain things, and as I said, generally speaking, I can go along with it. We're all off to Dublin in the Green of the Soldier song or something. I don't think they're particularly offensive, but I do remember being at games and some of the fans would be singing offensive stuff, because that was, they were singing about what was happening in Northern Ireland at that time. Now, it happened and there was no condemnation, nobody said anything. As I said, it was almost accepted practice that that's who we are, that's what we do, generally speaking. Now, across the Ibrox, they're singing songs about Ulster paramilitaries, they're singing songs about Derry's Walls, No Surrender, the Billy Boys, and whatever it was. And that was accepted practice because that is what they were seen as being, that was their culture, their identity. And they were allowed to get on with it, rightly or wrongly. But what really frustrates me these days is, I know guys that watch Rangers games on the telly to listen to what they're singing so they can complain and get offended. Now, personally speaking, Rangers could be playing in my street, then I would shut the curtains. I'm not interested. Maybe when they come back in the SPL in any shape or form, I'll take an interest of some sort, because they're on their radar. But see, right now, while they're not in their league, I couldn't care less what Rangers say. And there is this thing, maybe it's social media, maybe it's the internet, we're living in the modern age. Both sides are guilty of the offended bus.
Yep.
As soon as something happens, it's, I'm writing to the papers, I'm writing to the SFA, I'm writing to the TV, they sang this, they sang that. Sometimes even songs get sung that get misconstrued. I mean, do you remember the thing last season that Celtic had a banner and some idiot actually thought it was something to do with ISIS?
Yes, that's right. I
remember it was something Ireland Celtic Supporters Club, and it was black and white with Gaelic writing. And some mentors was actually watching that on TV and started a rumour on Twitter that it was something to do with ISIS. So I don't have a problem with what Rangers fans think, frankly. You know, we're adults, you know, I don't get offended very easily, especially at football games. So this thing these days that you've got, that everybody gets offended, and there's a bit, the what about today, they do it worse than us, they do it longer than us, they do it louder than us, I just find that rips me apart.
Oh, I can't be bored. There are people, and as you say, there are people on both sides of the Glasgow divide who, they seem to be watching the other team's game to be offended.
And that's what they do. Actually, and as they're watching it, they're tweeting it. They can't even watch it in peace. They're constantly on Twitter, or they're on one of these websites like Follow, or whatever they call it. And as soon as the Celtic fans sing something that they find offensive, they just get hammered away at it. And this makes it worse as well, because then the authorities hear people complaining, whether they're cranks or no cranks. It's sometimes hard to differentiate. But the authorities, whether it be the SFA, the government, the police or whoever, they hear this happen and they think, you know what, we need to do something about this. Whereas in the old days, there was a sort of mutual respect. You sing what you want to, we'll sing what we want to, and you know what, we'll carry on.
I mean, in that regard about what football does about it, it gets back to the stuff that I'd written a few articles on at the end of last year about the economic value. I think football allows itself to get a kicking and allows the politicians, because football doesn't know what it's worth.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Because see, football knew what it was worth, as I would do. I mean, I've done the stuff, and actually I did that piece where I said that football was worth £200 million a year to the Glasgow economy. There was a report on the Premier League to the House of Lords, which I was looking at this week, and I underestimated how much football generates when I said it was worth £200 million. Because based on the analysis that the English Tourist Board have done, so I can't see they'd be dramatically different, that every non-English person who comes to England to watch a Premiership game while they're over, they spend on average £785 per person when they per visit.
Well, you can imagine it would be souvenirs, food, drink, hotels.
Go stay in the hotel, going to bars, going to restaurants and all that sort of stuff, and transport around. And then maybe using the going to the game as an excuse to then stay for 2 or 3 days and go to other things, because the average, and then that ignores, obviously this isn't relevant to Rangers, but it ignores how much tax the football industry pays and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the average spectator or the average visitor to the UK spends something like £570, and the average attendee and the average tourist to the UK who comes to watch football spends £785, so it's £200 more for football.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at one of the articles I did before Christmas, there's 250,000 people come to Glasgow every year from outside Scotland to watch football.
Yeah.
Well, based on that 785, that's £200 million alone out of those visitors. So, see this, football needs to know its worth, because when you know your worth, you can start saying to the politicians, we generate this. So actually, see, instead of you making it, playing our game down and decrying our game and being critical and actually getting the result where people don't want to go and they'd rather go to the rugby because the rugby's a bit more acceptable to go to than the football. See, for every person you do that, you cost your economy money. And in fact, I can tell you how much you cost, because if we've lost 10,000 people because of your behaviour, you have cost your economy X pounds. That's how you need to start speaking to the politicians. And also, And I get sometimes at times that Celtic talk about we play a softly, softly game and we like to do things in the background and you can see positive results from things that have happened in the background. And I'm one for, you know, I negotiate for a living. So I used to negotiate for a living. So I appreciate that sometimes, you know, shouting at people's not the best way to win them over. But sometimes when you know you're not getting anywhere, you need to kick up a bit of a fuss. And my criticism of Celtic is they are too softly, softly all the time. You start speaking to the politicians and you say, you get rid of that act because it's part, you know, one of my favourite phrases is perception becomes reality. If you continually have the Offensive Behaviour Act and you have journalists who, when Celtic go away from home in Europe, put in a fantastic performance and the first question they ask about is, what about the one guy who did the flare? If you don't deal with that by saying something like, and this is a point I've made to Celtic many times, see, every single time you're asked a question about the behaviour of the supporters, I would answer it along the lines of, I'm glad you mentioned the behaviour of supporters, because this week the Celtic support generated, we did a bucket collection prior to the Motherwell game and generated £12,000 for the Celtic FC Foundation, which was part of £110,000 that we spent on giving 200 people, 200 families a better Christmas than they would have had. So when you're talking about what football supporters do and don't do, there's what the Celtic supporters did. Now, you're asking about one guy. Okay, let's go into that. And see if you kept doing that. Firstly, the press would get fed up asking the question about the one guy with the flare. But secondly, it's all about the general thing of football's permanently on the back foot, letting the politicians and the media set the negative agenda. And the way that you get on the front foot is by doing that thing of, wait a minute, can I just ask why, in a week when we've published a report which demonstrates that football generates £250 million for the Scottish economy, you've asked me why, that negative question? You continually just reinforce, because my point about perception becomes reality, if you continually have the media coverage of flares, buses being stopped for drink, offensive behaviour stuff, see the guy who's not that much of a football fan, but his two wee boys start to get into football. Is he going to take the boys to the football game, or is he going to be thinking, I don't want to go there because it's full of mad guys? And so football then loses those two kids, and he prefers to take his kids to the basketball or the ice hockey or the rugby or just do something else. Enough of flares. We'll leave them in the 1970s. We're in the January transfer window, and really there's not been much Celtic chat of players coming in, but there has been Celtic chat of players going out, and you were tweeting today about keeping Anthony Stokes. The point I was making was you and I are as close to playing first team football as Anthony Stokes is. So if there's a guy who's just not part of it, we may as well see if we can cut his wage bill and get him off.
I just get frustrated because for the last so many years, we've been letting players go and bringing in players who are worse than the ones that we're selling, ever letting go. And I look at Stokes and I think, in my opinion, humble opinion, he's the second best striker we've got at the club after Lee Griffiths. Because I don't think Chiefty's good enough, and I think Callum Cole's best days are long gone. So I don't think he's a long-term option either. So while he's at the club, and he might not be here at the club for much longer, then I would find a place for Stokes in or around the team. Might not be playing him every week, but I would definitely have him on the bench. And if we do let him go, then we need to make sure that we sign a quality striker. And our record in the transfer market for strikers in the last 5 years is horrendous. I don't think we've seen a decent one since Gary Hooper. And we must have had maybe anything up to 10 strikers coming in the door and out the door in that time. And none of them have been up to the job. And that's a real worry for me because let's just say, for example, that Lee Griffiths gets a bad injury and you have to rely, and Stokes is away, and you need to rely on Carlton Cole and Chiefty. That is a desperate situation to be in.
But we have had Stokes and Griffiths injured, and we did.
Yeah, but not for a long term. What I'm saying is that was for a wee short period that we managed to get by, and I accept it. But you're saying Chiefty scored a couple of goals at St Johnstone, and he looked as if he might have turned the corner. But generally speaking, when you see Chiefty and Cole playing, they don't fill me with glee. I don't see a great deal in either of them as long term options. And the thought of relying on the two of them, if Griffiths gets injured between January and May, it just fills me with dread.
Now, I agree with you in that we need additional strikers. And actually, do you know, it was during the Thistle game, and I was saying that I'd rather bring Skepovic back than have Chiefty up front if Griffiths is injured.
Well, do you know something? In the games that I saw Skepovic play, I never thought he was that bad. I think the problem with Skepovic and some of the other guys who are strikers is, with the formation that we play, but there's only one man up front, it's really hard to come on and, say for example, Skepovic comes on after 65 minutes. It's really hard to come on and play as the lone striker for the last 25 minutes of a game when you're cold, when you're coming on, you know, like and having to find the pace of the game and having to find your feet. It's often easier when you come on with a strike partner who you can talk to and say, well, you know, I'll drop deep, or we'll play off each other, I'll go for the headers, you go for the knock-on. I really feel for the Celtic striker, because that one-man lone striker role, it's a hard role to play. But I have to say, any time I saw Skepovic, don't get me wrong, I don't think he was not doing any threes particularly, but I think he had a wee bit more to him than the other two guys that we've got at the moment.
And the only thing I would then say about the Stokes thing is, if there's been a variety of reasons, and not just what he tweeted, as to why he's not in the team, then I'm trying to think of how to put this in a way that I don't need to run it past lawyers before I put it in. I understand there's a variety of reasons as to why he's not in the team, and it's not just his footballing ability, and it's not just stuff that happened under Ronnie Dyla, but stuff that happened under Neil Lennon prior to Ronnie Dyla. And so it's a legacy thing. It's the reasons for it.
I don't think there's any secret that he's been a naughty boy in certain respects. And it's not the first time that he's maybe been suspended, or the club have took action against him in some shape or form. So in many ways, he's only got himself to blame. And if you look across to Ireland, guys like Don Givens, for example, who was part of the Ireland football management team structure for a wee while, said that his attitude was poor and he didn't turn up on occasions to play for the Republic. So probably a wee bit of an attitude problem there with Stokes, but I obviously don't think he's got any long-term future at Celtic. My only problem is I'm more worried about the short term. Between now and the end of the season, should we not get a decent striker in? And this is a hard time of year to go and get a decent striker. Nobody wants to sell their good players. If you're going for the silverware, you definitely don't want to sell your players. And if you're down at the bottom of the league facing relegation, you also don't want to sell your better players. But the other thing that surprises me as well is Michael O'Halloran is allegedly being looked at by Celtic. How many attacking midfield players does Ronny Dyla need in the one squad?
I'm not sure if Michael O'Halloran is being looked at by Celtic or whether that's been put out there either by his agent to try and get Rangers to pay the price,
mm-hmm.
or by mischief-making people because we've come in and taken Allen away from Rangers. Because
mm-hmm.
I do think Rangers at the moment are going through that process of, I think, you know, next I think they'll be putting in a bid for Messi.
Oh,
and then they'll get their mates in the press to say that Barcelona are being unrealistic with their asking price and they're just going to change their mind about me and they'll just go somewhere else and not get Messi. I think there's an element of putting deliberately. Remember, it happened under Gordon Smith in the Craig White era that then, just before they went into administration, where they started putting bids in for people that were below what would be accepted, but it made it look as though they were doing stuff.
Yeah, the worst example of that was David Goodwillie when Dundee United wanted to sell him, and it became like an option between Rangers and Blackburn. And apparently, if you believe the media, Rangers put in like 14 bids. Now, the joke at the time was I'd offered 500,000, and then it was 500,000 in £1, 500,000 in £2, you know, 14 times or whatever. But no, again, you're not getting a true reflection of that in the mainstream media.
Oh, because, I mean, the Brentford guy they were interested in, I understand that they offered, that the Brentford were looking for 12 times whatever Rangers have offered. This Brentford striker they're interested in. I mean, when you consider that one of our problems is we couldn't get Gary Hooper back to Celtic because Gary Hooper would need to take something like a 20 grand pay cut. But Sheffield Wednesday might be able to match his wages that he's getting at Norwich.
But you wonder how they can manage that because they don't get great attendances and they don't get the English Premiership TV money. So
because the Championship, for example, is the fifth richest league in the world. So yeah, they're not getting Premiership money, but they're still getting money which is in excess of
what we're getting.
Also, they have a greater ability to get debt than we do. Because of the prospect. So, but your point about strikers, we obviously, if you look at players that we brought in, that we've had reasonable success at moving on, and so obviously Denier, Van Dijk, Matthews was a good right back, and Lustig has been good value for money, and Izaguirre's been reasonable value for money. And Beaton will be probably the next guy that we sell at a profit. Yeah. And Johansson, much as people have criticised him, he was quite cheap. So he's been not bad value for money. And Common's good value for money. But we're not good at picking strikers.
Well, there's something far amiss picking strikers. You know, and you've got guys, I don't know, we've done the European route and we've tried to bring in foreign players. They've brought in guys for the Spanish league. They've brought in guys on loan. And people used to say, oh, you should just stick to the guys in Scotland that know that the game. And then you find somebody like Chieftain, and you find he's not quite up to either. So
yeah, because I've heard people say, oh, we should have signed Stevie May when he was at St.
That's Johnson.
And he's now disappeared.
Billy McKay was the other one that used to get...
Yeah, Billy McKay, and I've also heard people say, oh, we should just go and get Adam Rooney off Aberdeen because he can score goals. He was a failure at Oldham, Adam Rooney. And yeah, he's scoring goals, but it's the same principle of, like I said before in the podcast, I'm not saying Chieftain's a decent player, but the rationale as to why we might have spent £1 million on Chieftain, I understood the concept of the point you've just made. Well, at least we know he might not be the greatest player, but he's proved
he's
he can score
in the Scottish game. Yeah.
15 goals, 20 goals in the top flight of Scotland, playing for a team who don't create as many chances as we do, so playing for Celtic... He'll be a good backup player. That rationale made sense to me. I'm not saying it was...
a Celtic class player, but the thought process. But granted, you know, I'm less hung up on the number of people who play in the striking position, but I do also get the point of, if you get Lee Griffiths scoring 22 goals already, the biggest, it's a, the problem you're getting to is the problem you've got of signing a backup goalkeeper.
He's not going to get a game.
He's not going to get a game.
No. Which is where the 4-2-3-1 in some aspects falls down. Because, as I said to you there, it's really hard for a striker to come on cold in a game and try and impress.
I remember speaking to, not even just strikers, any player coming on in a game, particularly when usually we will bring on a striker under two sets of circumstances, particularly at Celtic Park. It's 0-0, or we're losing 1-0.
And we need a goal.
And we need a goal, by which case everybody's desperate, and any missed chance, everybody goes nuts at. Or the opposite is, we're 3-0 up or 4-0 up. And so the rest of the team can't be bothered because they've already won the game. And I used to think this with Skepovic last season, that people would then say, ah, but he's actually had 150 minutes of football and only scored X number of goals. Yeah, but if you analysed it, how many times did he come on with 10 minutes to go and we were all in 3-0 up, and by this point all the other players were playing Hollywood balls?
Yeah.
And I remember speaking, being friendly with a player in the Gordon Strachan. It was Adam Virgo. I remember speaking to Adam Virgo, and he said, the biggest problem is when you're not getting a game and you get to come on for the last 10 minutes. And no matter how much the manager says to you and you're saying in your own head, just go on and do the basics and do your own game. You can't help but want to prove, you've only got 10 minutes to prove that you should be playing every week. He said, no matter what, you can't help but in your head, you're thinking, I want to prove it. And you go in for things where you shouldn't. But you're trying to prove that you're a great defender, and actually by diving into the tackle that you shouldn't dive in to prove you're a great defender, you actually make an arse of it and you look even worse. Now, okay, people might say, well, he was never a good player anyway, but you get the point. If you're coming on for the last 5-10 minutes, it's really difficult to go on and just play your normal game, because you might actually get one touch of the ball in 10 minutes. Playing your normal game, just because of the nature of it. So I agree with you that the one up front, the downside of it is, how does the guy who's not often getting a game look like he's worth it? And it's really difficult.
What's the score with Skepovic? Is there a possibility of him coming back in January?
I wouldn't have thought so. I think he's in the, you know how we talked in the last podcast about Ronnie Dyler's concept is for young players, he wants them to go out on loan to get first team football, so that actually they come into the first team squad, they play a handful of games, then they go out on loan to get 20 to 40 games with a team. So the following season they come back to Celtic and they're a first team player. That's what he wants to achieve with the younger players. I think Skepovic is in the opposite, is still in the old Celtic loan system of, a loan is the first step to going away and not coming back. I don't see Skepovic. I really hope. I did hear a rumour yesterday that we are interested in, or we have spoken to two strikers, one of which is Fletcher, and he's unlikely to come because we'll only take him if he's prepared to come on our terms. And he can get better money than from lots of English teams. And then the other one is a player who, all I was told was, we would not be disappointed if we managed to get him. And I've no idea who it is. But it wasn't from somebody at Celtic, it was from somebody out with Celtic who said that. So it's not like a Celtic person spinning it. But apart from that, we need a striker, and I'm just not hearing anything. Do you know actually what I think we need more than anything? We just need something that gets the fans chuffed that we've signed somebody. Not an average player. I remember, you know, the Jock Stein quote of, sometimes you just need to sign a player just for the sake of it sometimes.
No, but I think the real thing that we're missing at the moment is a personality player. a player that the fans can relate to, that they make up songs about, that you know, you can point out Larsson was exceptional. So I'd maybe be looking at, along the lines of maybe like other good players that we've had who had a bit of personality, like Nakamura, for example, who I thought was a wonderful player and had a wee bit of, he was different, he had a wee bit of personality, the fans sang songs about him, the kids all loved him, that kind of thing. So even somebody along the lines of Andy Tom was there, he was a big signing for us at the time, and he could do things that nobody else in the team could do. He just had a wee bit of magic in him in certain games, and there was games that he won you. There was Decanio as well that came in, Moravchik. So really, I think that what we really miss is a personality player, a flair player, somebody that can get you off your seat, somebody that you can actually get you excited. And I think the thing about our team at the moment is they're all good players, they're all good professionals, they're good individually, they're good collectively, but we lack a personality. And if they could just get it, and they don't come cheap, and you need to be a wee bit fortunate when you get them, because when you think of the cases of Larsson and Moravchik, had it not been for the manager that we had at the time, they wouldn't have came to Celtic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Larsson, I don't think they would have been interested in coming to Scotland if Janssen had been there. And Moravchik is actually on record as saying, I only came as a favour to Joe Vinglas. So these guys are really hard to get, but if he could just get a wee gem for somewhere, a forward, a winger, a midfield player, somebody that can beat a man, that can take a ball in a tight position, do a wee trick and come out of it.
Ibrahimovic.
Ibrahimovic, that'd be something, wouldn't it? So, whenever you play Ibrahimovic, you know, if you went up front, he'd be waiting in Griffiths to get injured.
I think we've managed to find a space for him. So we've gone through that. So we're recording this on a Thursday night. So tomorrow night or today, as people probably are listening to this, we've got Dundee United. So what's your predictions for Dundee United at Tannadice?
I am hoping for a 2-0 victory, and I say that for two reasons. Number one, because I think Dundee United, I'm sorry to say, are in a downward spiral. Number two, I think hopefully that we will maybe turn a wee corner and we seem to play better away from home than we do at home. And if you add all that up together, then I am hoping for a 2-0 victory.
I don't know how I've managed to let an hour of this podcast go by without saying this. You must have been chuffed to bits that we played two up front against Stranraer.
Listen, I know that you and I have had debates, and certainly I've had it on Twitter with other guys as well. I don't have a problem with one man up front. I don't have a problem with 4-2-3-1. The problem I have is I don't believe we've got the players to play that system. And he did play two up front. I don't think he'll do it again, because he was playing against Stranraer, and really he should be able to play five forward against Stranraer still. And B, I don't think Carlton Cole's got 90 minutes in him. So I can see that my thoughts for tomorrow is that Ronnie will revert back to type, and it'll be 4-2-3-1. We can assist leading the line.
So 4-2-3-1, we're going to win by two goals, and will there be pyro?
Part of me thinks there will be, because these guys are bloody minded and they're determined to do their own thing. And I think if there is pyro, then I fear, because somebody somewhere, whether it's SFA or someone within Celtic, will need to take drastic action to bring this to an end.
Well, with that note, positive or negative, I'll say, St. Anthony, thanks very much for joining the podcast.
Thanks to you, Harry.
Okay, cheers.
Bye-bye.
Hold me in the dark, wrap me in your skin, in the arms of threefold we ride.
I hope you enjoyed that ramble of a podcast. It was a bit all over the place, but then the fact that we've only had two games since the last podcast, and Celtic have done hee-haw in the transfer market to date, meant that there was other things to talk about, including, obviously, the use of flares at football. something that Saint and I first saw back in the 1970s. Sorry, bad joke. Anyway, I did say at the beginning that I'm whacking all my stuff onto my iTunes. So, first up is a couple of Silencers classics on this podcast. Who knows what's coming next? I bet you're all waiting with bated breath. Anyway, enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, St. Anthony. And this is me saying goodnight and God bless. Good night. Hold me till I scream. Lovers in a sailor of dreams. Imprisoned by these walls, in these arms of steel, in a world of colors, I cry. Soldiers of the night. To